extraordinary life, as he had done, and that one day, like Grandpa Portman, I would do something that mattered. He used to say to me, "You're going to be a great man, Jacob, a very great man."
"Like you?" I would ask him.
"Better," he'd reply.
I'd believed him then, and I still wanted to. But the more I learned about him, the longer his shadow became, and the more impossible it seemed that I could ever matter the way he had, that maybe it would be suicidal even to try. And when I imagined myself trying, thoughts of my father crept in, my poor, about-to-be-devastated father, and before I could push them out of my mind, I wondered how a great man could do something so terrible to someone who loved him. I began to shiver.
"You're cold," Emma said. "Let me finish what I started."
She picked up my other arm and kissed with her breath the whole length of it. It was almost more than I could handle. When she reached my shoulder, instead of placing the arm in my lap, she hung it around her neck. I lifted my other arm to join it, and she put her arms around me too, and our foreheads knotted together. Speaking very quietly, Emma said,
"I hope you don't regret the choice you made. I'm so glad you're here with us. I don't know what I'd do if you left. I fear I wouldn't be all right at all."
I thought about going back. For a moment, I really tried to play it out in my head, how it would be if I could somehow row one of our boats back to the island again and go back home. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't imagine. I whispered,
"How could I?" "When Miss Peregrine turns human again, she'll be able to send you back, if you want to go."
My question hadn't been about logistics. I had meant simply, how could I leave you? But those words were unsayable, couldn't find their way past my lips. So I held them inside, and instead, I kissed her. This time it was Emma whose breath caught short. Her hands rose to my cheeks, but stopped just shy of making contact. Heat radiated from them in waves.
"Touch me," I said. "I don't want to burn you," she said,
but a sudden shower of sparks inside my chest said, "I don't care." So I took her fingers and raked them along my cheek, and both of us gasped. It was hot, but I didn't pull away. Dared not, for fear she'd stop touching me. And then our lips met again, and we were kissing again, and her extraordinary warmth surged through me. My eyes fell closed. The world faded away. If my body was cold in the night mist, I didn't feel it. If the sea roared in my ears, I didn't hear it. If the rock I sat on was sharp and jagged, I hardly noticed. Everything outside the two of us was a distraction. And then a great crash echoed in the dark, but I thought nothing of it, could not take myself away from Emma, until the sound doubled and was joined by an awful shriek of metal, and a blinding light swept over us, and finally I couldn't shut it out any more.
"The lighthouse," I thought. "The lighthouse is falling into the sea."
But the lighthouse was a pinpoint in the distance, not a sun-bright flash, and its light only traveled in one direction, not back and forth, searching. It wasn't a lighthouse at all. It was a searchlight, and it was coming from the water close to shore. It was the searchlight of a submarine. Brief second of terror in which brain and legs were disconnected, my eyes and ears registered the submarine not far from shore, Metal beast rising from the sea, water rushing from its sides, men bursting onto its deck from open hatches, shouting, training cannons of light at us. And then the stimulus reached my legs, and we slid, fell, and pitched ourselves down from the rocks, and ran like hell. The spotlight threw our pistoning shadows across the beach, 10 feet tall and freakish. Bullets pocked the sand and buzzed the air. A voice boomed from a loudspeaker.
Stop! Do not run!
We burst into the cave.
They're coming! They're here! Get up! Get up!
But the children had heard the commotion and were already on their feet, all but Bronwyn, who had so exhausted herself at sea that she had fallen asleep against the cave wall and couldn't be roused. We shook her and shouted in her face, but she only moaned and brushed us away with a sweep of her arm. Finally, we had to hoist her up by the waist, which was like lifting a tower of bricks. But once her feet touched the ground, her red-rimmed eyelids split open, and she took her own weight. We grabbed up our things, thankful now that they were so small and so few. Emma scooped Miss Peregrine into her arms. We tore outside. As we ran into the dunes, I saw behind us a gang of silhouetted men splashing the last few feet to shore. In their hands, held above their heads to keep them dry, were guns. We sprinted through a stand of wind-blown trees and into the trackless forest. Darkness enveloped us. What moon wasn't already hidden behind clouds was blotted out now by trees, branches filtering its pale light to nil. There was no time for our eyes to adjust or to feel our way carefully or to do anything other than run in a gasping, stumbling herd with arms outstretched, dodging trunks that seemed to coalesce suddenly in the air just inches from us. After a few minutes we stopped, chests heaving, to listen. The voices were still behind us, only now they were joined by another sound. Dogs barking. We ran on.
Chapter 3. We tumbled through the black woods for what seemed like hours, no moon or movement of stars by which to judge the passing time. The sound of men shouting and dogs barking wheeled around us as we ran, menacing us from everywhere and nowhere. To throw the dogs off our scent, we waded into an icy stream and followed it until our feet went numb, and when we crossed out of it again, it felt like I was stumbling along on prickling stumps. After a time, we began to fail. Someone moaned in the dark. Olive and Claire started to fall behind, so Bronwyn hefted them into her arms, but then she couldn't keep up either. Finally, when Horace tripped over a root and fell to the ground, and then lay there begging for a rest, we all stopped.
"Up, you lazy sod!"
Enoch hissed at him, but he was wheezing too, and then he leaned against a tree to catch his breath, and the fight seemed to go out of him. We were reaching the limit of our endurance. We had to stop.
"It's no use running circles in the dark like this anyway," said Emma. "We could just as easily end up right back where we started."
"We'll be able to make better sense of this forest in the light of day," said Millard.
"Provided we live that long," said Enoch.
A light rain hissed down. Fiona made a shelter for us by coaxing a ring of trees to bend their lower branches together, petting their bark and whispering to their trunks until the branches meshed to form a watertight roof of leaves just high enough for us to sit beneath. We crawled in and lay listening to the rain and the distant barking of dogs. Somewhere in the forest, men with guns were still hunting us. Alone with our thoughts, I'm sure each of us was wondering the same thing. What might happen to us if we were caught? Claire began to cry, softly at first, but then louder and louder, until both of her mouths were bawling, and she could hardly catch a breath between sobs.
Get a hold of yourself,
Enix said.
They'll hear you, and then we'll all have something to cry about.
They're going to feed us to their dogs, she said. They're going to shoot holes in us and take Miss Peregrine away.
Bronwyn scooted next to her and wrapped the little girl in a bear hug.
Please, Claire, you've got to think about something else.
I'm trying, she wailed.
Try harder.
Claire squeezed her eyes shut, drew in a deep breath, and held it until she looked like a balloon about to pop, then burst into a fit of gasping cough sobs that were louder than ever. Enoch clapped his hands over her mouths.
Shh! I'm sorry,
she blubbered.
Maybe if I could hear a story, one of the tales.
Not this again, said Millard. I'm beginning to wish we'd lost those damned books at sea with the rest of our things.
Miss Peregrine spoke up, in as much as she was able to, hopping atop Bronwyn's trunk and tapping it with her beak. Inside, along with the rest of our meager possessions, were the tales.
I'm with Miss P, said Enoch. It's worth a try. Anything to stop her bawling.
All right then, little one, Bronwyn said. But just one tale, and you've got to promise to stop crying.
I promise,
Claire sniffled. Bronwyn opened the trunk and pulled out a waterlogged volume of Tales of the Peculiar. Emma scooted close and lit the tiniest wisp of flame on her fingertip to read by. Then Miss Peregrine, apparently impatient to pacify Claire, took one edge of the book's cover in her beak and opened it to a seemingly random chapter. In a hushed voice, Bronwyn began to read.
Once upon a peculiar time, in a forest deep and ancient, there roamed a great many animals. There were rabbits and deer and foxes, just as there are in every forest. But there were animals of a less common sort, too, like stilt-legged grim bears and two-headed lynxes and talking emu ruffs. These peculiar animals were a favourite target of hunters, who loved to shoot them and mount them on walls and show them off to their hunter friends, but loved even more to sell them to zookeepers, who would lock them in cages and charge money to view them. Now, you might think it would be far better to be locked in a cage than to be shot and mounted upon a wall, but peculiar creatures must roam free to be happy, and after a while the spirits of caged ones wither, and they begin to envy their wall-mounted friends.
This is a sad story, Claire groused. Tell a different one.
I like it, said Enoch. Tell more about the shooting and mounting.
Bronwyn ignored them both.
Now this was an age when giants still roamed the earth, she went on, as they did in the long-ago Aldin times, though they were few in number and diminishing. And it just so happened that one of these giants lived near the forest, and he was very kind and spoke very softly, and ate only plants, and his name was Cuthbert. One day Cuthbert came into the forest to gather berries, and there saw a hunter hunting an emu ruff. Being the kindly giant that he was, Cuthbert picked up the little ruff by the scruff of its long neck, and by standing up to his full height, on tiptoe, which he rarely did because it made all his old bones crackle, Cuthbert was able to reach up very high and deposit the emu ruff on a mountain top, well out of danger. Then, just for good measure, he squashed the hunter to jelly between his toes. Word of Cuthbert's kindness spread throughout the forest, and soon peculiar animals were coming to him every day, asking to be lifted up to the mountain top and out of danger. And Cuthbert said,
I'll protect you, little brothers and sisters. All I ask in return is that you talk to me and keep me company. There aren't many giants left in the world, and I get lonely from time to time." And they said, "Of course, Cuthbert, we will." So every day Cuthbert saved more peculiar animals from the hunters, lifting them up to the mountain by the scruffs of their necks, until there was a whole peculiar menagerie up there, and the animals were happy there, because they could finally live in peace. And Cuthbert was happy too, because if he stood on his tiptoes and rested his chin on the top of the mountain, he could talk to his new friends all he liked. Then one morning a witch came to see Cuthbert. He was bathing in a little lake in the shadow of the mountain, when she said to him, "I'm terribly sorry, but I've got to turn you into stone now." "Why would you do something like that?" asked the giant. "I'm very kindly, a helping sort of giant." And she said, "I was hired by the family of the hunter you squashed." "Ah," he replied, "forgot about him." "I'm terribly sorry," the witch said again, and then she waved a birch branch at him and poor Cuthbert turned to stone. All of a sudden, Cuthbert became very heavy, so heavy that he began to sink into the lake. He sank and sank and didn't stop sinking until he was covered in water all the way up to his neck. His animal friends saw what was happening, and though they felt terrible about it, they decided they could do nothing to help him.
"I know you can't save me," Cuthbert shouted up to his friends, "but at least come and talk to me. I'm stuck down here and so very lonely. But if we come down there, the hunters will shoot us," they called back. Cuthbert knew they were right, but still he pleaded with them. "Talk to me," he cried. "Please come and talk to me." The animals tried singing and shouting to poor Cuthbert from the safety of the mountain top, but they were too distant and their voices too small, so that even to Cuthbert and his giant ears they sounded quieter than the whisper of leaves in the wind. "Talk to me," he begged. "Come and talk to me." But they never did, and he was still crying when his throat turned to stone like the rest of him. The end.
Bronwyn closed the book. Claire looked appalled.
"That's it?"
Enoch began to laugh.
"That's it," Bronwyn said.
"That's a terrible story," said Claire. "Tell another one."
"A story's a story," said Emma, "and now it's time for bed."
Claire pouted, but she had stopped crying, so the tale had served its purpose.
"Tomorrow's not likely to be any easier than today was," said Millard. "We'll need what rest we can get."
We gathered cuts of springy moss to use as pillows, Emma drying the rain from them with her hands before we tucked them under our heads. Lacking blankets, we nestled together for warmth, Bronwyn cuddling the small ones, Fiona entangled with Hugh, whose bees came and went from his open mouth as he snored, keeping watch over their sleeping master, Horace and Enoch shivering with their backs to one another, too proud to snuggle, myself with Emma. I lay on my back, and she in the crook of my arm, head on my chest, her face so invitingly close to mine that I could kiss her forehead any time I liked, and I wouldn't have stopped, except that I was as tired as a dead man, and she was as warm as an electric blanket, and pretty soon I was asleep and dreaming pleasant, forgettable nothings. I never remember nice dreams. Only the bad ones stick. It was a miracle that I could sleep at all, given the circumstances. Even here, running for our lives, sleeping exposed, facing death, even here, in her arms, I was able to find some measure of peace. Watching over us all, her black eyes shining in the dark, was Miss Peregrine. Though damaged and diminished, she was still our protector. The night turned raw, and Claire began to shake and cough. Bronwyn nudged Emma awake and said,
"Miss Bloom, the little one needs you. I'm afraid she's taking ill."
And with a whispered apology, Emma slipped out of my arms to go and attend to Claire. I felt a twinge of jealousy, then guilt for being jealous of a sick friend. So I lay alone, feeling irrationally forsaken, and stared into the dark, more exhausted than I had ever been, and yet unable now to sleep. Listening to the others shift and moan in the grip of nightmares that could not have equaled the one we would likely wake to. And eventually, the dark peeled back, layer by layer, and with imperceptible gradations, the sky feathered to a delicate pale blue. At dawn, we crawled from our shelter. I picked moss out of my hair and tried in vain to brush the mud from my pants, but succeeded only in smearing it, making me look like some bog creature vomited from the earth. I was hungry in a way I'd never experienced, my belly gnawing at itself from the inside, and I ached just about everywhere it was possible to ache, from rowing and running and sleeping on the ground. Still, a few mercies prevailed. Overnight, the rain had let up, the day was warming by degrees, and we seemed to have evaded the whites and their dogs, at least for the time being. Either they'd stopped barking, or were too far away to be heard. In doing so, we'd gotten ourselves hopelessly lost. The forest was no easier to navigate by day than it had been in the dark. Green-boughed firs stretched away in endless, disordered rows, each direction a mirror of the others. The ground here was a carpet of fallen leaves that hid any tracks we might have made the night before. We'd woken in the heart of a green labyrinth without a map or compass, and Miss Peregrine's broken wing meant she couldn't fly above the tree line to guide us. Enoch suggested we raise Olive above the trees like we had in the fog, but we didn't have any rope to hold her, and if she slipped and fell into the sky, we'd never get her back again. Claire was sick and getting sicker, and lay curled in Bronwyn's lap, sweat beading her forehead despite a chill in the air. She was so skinny I could count her ribs through her dress. "Will she be all right?" I asked.
"She's feverish," Bronwyn said, pressing a hand to the girl's cheek. "She needs medicine."
"First we'll have to find our way out of this accursed forest," said Millard.
"First we should eat," said Enoch. "Let's eat and discuss our options."
"What options?" said Emma. "Pick a direction and we'll walk in it. Any one's as good as another."
In sullen silence we sat and ate. I've never tasted dog food, but I'm sure this was worse. Brownish squares of congealed meat fat from rusted tins, which, lacking utensils, we dug out with our fingers.
"I packed 5 salted game hens and 3 tins of foie gras with cornichons,"
Horace said bitterly.
"And this is what survives our shipwreck."
He held his nose and dropped a gelatinous nugget down his throat without chewing.
"I think we're being punished."
"For what?" said Emma. "We've been perfect angels. Well, most of us."
"The sins of past lives, maybe. I don't know."
"Peculiars don't have past lives," said Millard. "We live them all at once."
We finished quickly, buried our empty tins, and prepared to go. Just as we were about to, Hugh burst through a thicket of bushes into our makeshift camp, bees circling his head in an agitated cloud. He was out of breath with excitement.
"Where have you been?"
Enoch demanded.
"I needed some privacy, to attend to my morning, never you mind," Hugh said.
"And I found..."
"Who gave you permission to be out of visual range?"
Enoch said.
We nearly left without you.
Who says I need permission? Anyway, I saw...
You can't just wander away like that. What if you'd gotten lost?
We're already lost.
You ignoramus! What if you couldn't find your way back?
I left a trail of bees, like I always do.
Would you kindly let him finish?
Emma shouted.
Thank you, said Hugh,
and then he turned and pointed back the way he'd come.
I saw water, quite a lot of it, through the trees there.
Emma's face clouded. She said,
We're trying to get away from the sea, not back to it. We must have doubled back on ourselves in the night.
We followed Hugh back the way he'd come, Bronwyn carrying Miss Peregrine on her shoulder, and poor sick Claire in her arms. After 100 yards, a glisten of grey ripples appeared beyond the trees, some wide body of water.
Oh, this is just awful, said Horace. They've chased us right back into their arms.
I don't hear any soldiers, said Emma. In fact, I don't hear anything at all. Not even the ocean.
Enoch said,
That's because it's not the ocean, you dolt.
And he stood up and ran toward the water. When we caught up with him, he was standing with his feet planted in wet sand, looking back at us with a self-satisfied, I told you so grin. He'd been right. This wasn't the sea. It was a misty gray lake, wide and ringed with firs, its calm surface smooth as slate. But its most distinguishing feature was something I didn't notice right away, not until Claire pointed out a large rock formation jutting from the shadows nearby. My eyes skimmed it at first, but then went back for a second glance. There was something eerie about it, and decidedly familiar.
"It's the giant from the story,"
said Claire, pointing from her place in Bronwyn's arms.
"It's Cuthbert!"
Bronwyn stroked her head.
"Shh, honey, you've got fever." "Don't be ridiculous," said Enoch. "It's just a rock."
But it wasn't. Though wind and rain had worn its features some, it looked just like a giant who'd sunk up to its neck in the lake. You could see clearly that it had a head, and a neck, and a nose, and even an Adam's apple, and some scrubby trees were growing atop it like a crown of wild hair. But what was really uncanny was the position of its head, thrown back, with its mouth open, as if, like the giant in the story we'd heard just last night, it had turned to stone while crying out to its friends on the mountain top.
"And look,"
said Olive, pointing at a rocky bluff rising in the distance.
"That must be Cuthbert's mountain."
"Giants are real,"
Claire murmured, her voice weak but full of wonder.
"And so are the tales."
"Let's not jump to absurd conclusions," said Enoch. "What's more likely, that the writer of the tale we read last night was inspired by a rock that just happened to be shaped like a giant head, or that this head-shaped rock was really a giant?"
"You take the fun out of everything," said Olive. "I believe in giants, even if you don't."
"The tales are just tales and nothing more," Enoch grumbled.
"Funny," I said. "That's exactly what I thought all of you were, before I met you." Olive laughed.
"Jacob, you're silly. You really thought we were made up?"
"Of course. And even after I met you, I still did, for a while. Like maybe I was losing my mind."
"Real or not, it's an incredible coincidence," said Millard. "To have been reading that story just last night, and then happen upon the very bit of geography that inspired it the next morning, what are the chances?"
"I don't think it's a coincidence," Emma said. "Miss Peregrine opened the book herself, remember? She must have chosen that story on purpose."
Bronwyn turned to look at the bird on her shoulder and said,
"Is that right, Miss P?"
"Why?"
"Because it means something," said Emma.
"Absolutely," said Enoch.
It means we should go and climb that bluff. Then maybe we'll see a way out of this forest.
I mean the tail means something, said Emma. In a story, what was it the giant wanted, that he had asked for over and over again?
Someone to talk to,
Olive answered like an eager student.
Exactly, said Emma. So if he wants to talk, let's hear what he has to say.
And with that, she waded into the lake. We watched her go, slightly perplexed.
Where's she heading? Said Millard.
He seemed to be asking me. I shook my head.
We've got whites chasing us, Enoch shouted after her. We're desperately lost. What on bird's green earth are you thinking?
I'm thinking peculiarly,
Emma shouted back. She sloshed through the shallows to the base of the rock, then climbed up to its jaw and peered into its open mouth.
Well?
I called.
What do you see?
Don't know,
she replied.
Looks like it goes down a long way, though. I'd better get a closer look.
Emma hoisted herself into the giant's stone mouth.
You'd better come down from there before you get hurt, shouted Horace. You're making everyone anxious.
Everything makes you anxious, Hugh said.
Emma tossed a rock down the giant's throat, listening for whatever sound came back. She started to say,
I think it might be a...
but then slipped on loose gravel, and her last word was lost as she scrambled and caught herself before she could fall.
Be careful!
I shouted, my heart racing.
Wait! I'm coming too!
I splashed into the lake after her.
It might be a what?
Called Enoch.
Only one way to find out,
Emma said excitedly, and climbed farther into the giant's mouth.
Oh, Lord, said Horace. There she goes.
Wait!
I shouted again, but she was gone already, disappeared down the giant's throat. The giant appeared even larger up close than it had from the shore, and peering down into its dark throat, I swore I could almost hear old Cuthbert breathing. I cupped my hands and called Emma's name. My own voice came echoing back. The others were wading into the lake now, too, but I couldn't wait for them. What if she was in trouble down there? So I gritted my teeth, lowered my legs into the dark, and let go. I fell for a long time, a full second, then splash, a plunge into water so cold it made me gasp, all my muscles constricting at once. I had to remind myself to tread water or sink. I was in a dim, narrow chamber filled with water, with no way back up the giant's long, smooth throat. No rope, no ladder, no footholds. I shouted for Emma, but she was nowhere around. Oh, God, I thought. She's drowned. But then something tickled my arms, and bubbles began breaking all around me, and a moment later, Emma broke the surface, gasping for breath. She looked okay by the pale light.
What are you waiting for?
She said, slapping the water with her hand like she wanted me to dive down with her.
Come on!
Are you insane?
I said.
We're trapped in here!
Of course we're not,
she said. Bronwyn's voice called from above.
Hello? I hear you down there. What have you found?
I think it's a loop entrance,
Emma called back.
Tell everyone to jump in and don't be afraid. Jacob and I will meet you on the other side.
And then she took my hand, and though I didn't quite understand what was going on, I drew a deep breath and let her pull me underwater. We flipped and scissor-kicked downward toward a person-sized hole in the rock through which a gleam of daylight was visible. She pushed me inside and then came after, and we swam through a shaft about 10 feet long and then out into the lake. Above us, I could see its rippling surface, and above that, the blue, refracted sky. And as we rose toward it, the water warmed dramatically. Then we broke into the air and gasped for breath, and instantly I could feel that the weather had changed. It was hot and muggy now, and the light had changed to that of a golden afternoon. The depth of the lake had changed too. Now it came all the way to the giant's chin.
"See?"
Emma said, grinning.
"We're someone else!"
And just like that, we'd entered a loop, abandoned a mild morning in 1940 for a hot afternoon in some other, older year, though it was difficult to tell just how much older, here in the forest, away from the easily datable cues of civilization. One by one, the other children surfaced around us, and seeing how much things had changed, had their own realizations.
"Do you realize what this means?"
Millard squealed. He was splashing around, turning in circles, out of breath with excitement.
"It means there's secret knowledge embedded in the tales!" "Not so useless now, are they?"
said Olive.
"Oh, I can't wait to analyze and annotate them,"
said Millard, rubbing his hands together.
"Don't you dare write in my book, Millard Nullings," said Bronwyn.
"But what is this loop?"
asked Hugh.
"Who do you think lives here?"
Olive said,
"Cuthbert's animal friends, of course."
Enoch rolled his eyes, but stopped short of saying what he was probably thinking.
"It's just a story."
Maybe because his mind was starting to change too.
"Every loop has an Imbrin," said Emma. "Even mystery loops from storybook tales. So let's go and find her."
"All right,"
said Millard.
"Where?" "The only place the story made mention of, aside from this lake, was that mountain,"
Emma said, indicating the bluff beyond the trees.
"Who's ready to do some climbing?"
We were tired and hungry, every one of us, but finding the loop had given us a burst of new energy. We left the stone giant behind and set off through the woods toward the foot of the bluff, our clothes drip-drying quickly in the heat. As we neared the bluff, the ground began to slope upward, and then a well-worn path appeared, and we followed it up and up through clusters of brushy firs and winding rocky passages until the path became so vertical in places that we had to go on all fours, clawing at the angled ground to pull ourselves forward.
"There'd better be something wonderful at the end of this trail,"
said Horace, dabbing sweat from his forehead.
"A gentleman doesn't perspire."
The path narrowed to a ribbon, the ground rising sharply on our right side and dropping away on the left, a carpet of green treetops spreading beyond it.
"Hug the wall,"
Emma warned.
"It's a long way down."
Just glancing at the drop-off made me dizzy. Suddenly, it seemed, I had developed a new and stomach-clenching fear of heights, and it took all my concentration simply to put one foot in front of the other. Emma touched my arm.
"Are you all right?" she whispered. "You look pale."
I lied and said I was, and succeeded in faking all rightness for exactly 3 more twists in the path, at which point my heart was racing and my legs shaking so badly that I had to sit down, right there in the middle of the narrow path, blocking everyone behind me.
"Oh dear," Hugh muttered. "Jacob's cracking up."
"I don't know what's wrong with me," I muttered. I'd never been afraid of heights before, but now I couldn't so much as look off the edge of the path without my stomach doing flips. Then something terrible occurred to me. What if this wasn't a fear of heights I was feeling, but of hollows? It couldn't be, though. We were inside a loop, where hollows couldn't go, and yet the more I studied the feeling churning in my gut, the more convinced I became that it wasn't the drop itself that bothered me, but something beyond it. I had to see for myself. Everyone chattered anxiously in my ear, asking what was the matter, was I okay? I shut out their voices, tipped forward onto my hands, and crawled toward the edge of the path. The closer I got,
the worse my stomach felt, like it was being clawed to shreds from the inside. Inches away, I pressed my chest flat to the ground and reached out to hook my fingers over the ledge, then dragged myself forward until I could peek over it. It took my eyes a moment to spot the hollow. At first it was just a shimmer against the craggy mountainside, a quivering spot in the air like heat waves rising from a hot car. An error, barely detectable. This was how they looked to normals and to other peculiars, to anyone who could not do what I did. Then I actually experienced my peculiar ability coming to life. Very quickly, the churning in my belly contracted and focused into a single point of pain, and then, in a way I can't fully explain, it became directional, lengthening from a point into a line, from one dimension to two. The line, like a compass needle, pointed diagonally at that faltering spot 100 yards below and to the left on the mountainside, the waves and shimmers of which began to gather and coalesce into solid black mass, a humanoid thing made from tentacles and shadow, clinging to the rocks. And then it saw me see it, and its whole awful body drew taut. Hunkering close against the rocks, it unhinged its saw-toothed mouth and let loose an ear-splitting shriek. My friends didn't need me to describe what I was seeing. The sound alone was enough.
"Hello!"
someone shouted.
"Run!"
shouted another, belaboring the obvious. I scrambled back from the ledge and was pulled to my feet, and then we were all running in a pack, not down the mountain but up it, farther into the unknown rather than back toward the flat ground and loop exit that lay behind us. But it was too late to turn back. I could feel the hollow leaping from boulder to crag up the cliffside, but away from us, down the path, to cut us off in case we tried to run past it down the mountain. It was trapping us. This was new. I'd never been able to track a hollow with anything other than my eyes before, but now I felt that little compass needle inside me pointing behind us, and I could almost picture the creature scrambling toward flat ground. It was as if, upon seeing the hollow, I'd planted a sort of homing beacon in it with my eyes. We raced around a corner, my fleeting fear of heights now apparently gone, and were confronted by a smooth wall of rock, 50 feet high at least. The path ended here. All around us the ground fell away at crazy angles. The wall had no ladders, no handholds. We searched frantically for some other way, a secret passage in the rock, a door, a tunnel, but there was none, and no way forward but up, and no way up, apparently, other than via hot air balloon or the helping hand of a probably mythical giant. Panic took hold. Miss Peregrine began to screech and Claire to cry as Horace stood and wailed,
"This is the end! We're all going to die!"
The rest looked for last-ditch ways to save ourselves. Fiona dragged her hands along the wall, searching for crevices that might contain soil from which she could grow a vine or something else we could climb. Hugh ran to the edge of the path and peered over the drop-off.
"We could jump! If only we had a parachute!"
"I can be a parachute!" said Olive. "Take hold of my legs!"
But it was a long way down, and at the bottom was dark and dangerous forest. It was better, Bronwyn decided, to send Olive up the rock face than down the mountain, and with limp, feverish Claire in one arm, Bronwyn led Olive by the hand to the wall.
"Give me your shoes," she said to Olive. "Take Claire and Miss P and get to the top as quick as you can."
Olive looked terrified.
"I don't know if I'm strong enough," she cried.
"You've got to try, little magpie. You're the only one who can keep them safe."
And she knelt and set Claire down on her feet, and the sick girl tottered into Olive's arms. Olive squeezed her tight, slipped off her leaden shoes, and then, just as they began to rise, Bronwyn transferred Miss Peregrine from her shoulder to the top of Olive's head. Weighed down, Olive rose very slowly. It was only when Miss Peregrine began to flap her good wing and pull Olive up by the hair, Olive yelping and kicking her feet, that the three of them really took off. The hollow had nearly reached level ground. I knew it as surely as if I could see it with my eyes. Meanwhile, we scoured the ground for anything that might be used as a weapon, but all we could find were pebbles.
"I can be a weapon," said Emma,
and she clapped her hands and drew them apart again, an impressive fireball roaring to life between them.
"And don't forget about my bees," said Hugh,
opening his mouth to let them out.
"They can be fierce when provoked."
Enoch, who always found a way to laugh at the most inappropriate times, let out a big guffaw.
"What are you going to do?" he said. "Pollinate it to death?"
Hugh ignored him, turning to me instead.
"You'll be our eyes, Jacob. Just tell us where the beast is, and we'll sting his brains out."
My compass needle of pain told me it was on the path now, and the way its venom was expanding to fill me meant it was closing in fast.
"Any minute now," I said,
pointing to the bend in the path we'd come around.
"Get ready."
If not for the adrenaline flooding my system, the pain would have been totally debilitating. We assumed fight-or-flight positions, some of us crouching with fists raised like boxers, others like sprinters before the starting gun, though no one knew which way to run.
"What a depressing and inauspicious end to our adventures," said Horace. "Devoured by a hollow in some Welsh backwater."
"I thought they couldn't enter loops," said Enoch. "How the hell did it get in here?"
"It would seem they have evolved," said Millard.
"Who gives a chuck how it happened?" Emma snapped. "It's here and it's hungry."
Then from above us, a small voice cried,
"Look out below!"
And I craned my neck to see Olive's face pull back and disappear over the top of the rock wall. A moment later, something like a long rope came sailing over the ledge. It unreeled and snapped taut, and then a net unfurled at the end of it and smacked against the ground.
"Hurry!"
came Olive's voice again.
"There's a lever up here! Everyone grab hold of the net, and I'll pull it!"
We ran to the net, but it was tiny, hardly large enough for two. Pinned to the rope at eye level was a photograph of a man inside the net, this very net, with his legs folded in front of him and hanging just above the ground before a sheer rock face, this very rock face. On the back of the photo, a message was printed. "Only access to menagerie. Climb inside. Weight limit, one rider. Strictly enforced." This contraption was some sort of primitive elevator, meant for one rider at a time, not eight. But there was no time to use it as intended, so we all dog-piled onto it, sticking our arms and legs through its holes, clinging to the rope above it, attaching ourselves any way we could.
"Take us up!"
I shouted, the hollow very close now, the pain extraordinary. For a few endless seconds, nothing happened. The hollow bolted around the bend, using its muscular tongues like legs, its atrophied human limbs hanging useless. Then a metallic squeal rang out, the rope pulled taut, and we lurched into the air. The hollow had nearly closed the distance between us. It galloped with jaws wide open, as if to collect us between its teeth the way a whale feeds on plankton. We weren't quite halfway up the wall when it reached the ground below us, looked up, and squatted like a spring about to uncoil.
"It's going to jump!" I shouted. "Pull your legs into the net!"
The hollow drove its tongues into the ground and sprang upward. We were rising fast, and it seemed like the hollow would miss us, but just as it reached the apex of its jump, one of its tongues shot out and lassoed Emma around the ankle. Emma screamed and kicked at it with her other foot as the net came to a jolting stop.
the pulley above too weak to raise all of us, and the hollow, too.
"Get it off me!" Emma shouted. "Get it off! Get it off! Get it off!"
I tried kicking at it, too, but the hollow's tongue was as strong as woven steel, and the tip was covered in hundreds of wriggling sucker cups, so that anyone who tried to pry the tongue off would only get stuck to it themselves. And then the hollow was reeling itself up, its jaws inching closer until we could smell its stinking grave breath. Emma shouted for someone to hold her, and with one hand I grabbed the back of her dress. Bronwyn let go of the net entirely, clinging to it with just her legs, then threw her arms around Emma's waist. Then Emma let go too, Bronwyn and I being all that kept her from falling, and with her hands now free, she reached down and clapped them around the tongue. The hollow shrieked. The sucker cups along its tongue withered, and reeking black smoke hissed from its flesh. Emma squeezed harder and closed her eyes and howled, not a cry of pain, I thought, but a kind of war cry, until the hollow was forced to release, its injured tentacle unslithering from around her ankle. There was a surreal moment where it was no longer the hollow who was holding Emma, but Emma who was holding the hollow, the thing writhing and shrieking below us, the acrid smoke of its burned flesh filling our noses, until finally we had to shout at her to let go, and Emma's eyes flew open again, and she seemed to remember where she was and pulled her hands apart. The hollow tumbled away from us, grasping at empty space as it fell. We rocketed up and away in the net, the tension that had been holding us down suddenly released, and soaring over the lip of the wall, we collapsed in a heap on top of it. Olive, Claire, and Miss Peregrine were waiting there for us, and as we extricated ourselves from the net and stumbled away from the cliff's edge, Olive cheered, Miss Peregrine screeched and beat her good wing, and Claire raised her head from where she'd been lying on the ground and gave a weak smile. We were giddy, and for the second time in as many days, stunned to be alive.
"That's twice you've saved our necks, little magpie," Bronwyn said to Olive. "And Miss Emma, I already knew you were brave, but that was beyond anything."
Emma shrugged it off.
"It was him or me," she said.
"I can't believe you touched it," said Horace.
Emma wiped her hands on her dress, held them to her nose, and made a face.
"I just hope this smell comes off soon," she said. "That beast stank like a landfill."
"How's your ankle?" I asked her. "Does it hurt?" She knelt and pushed down her sock to reveal a fat, red welt ringing it.
"Not too bad," she said, touching the ankle gingerly.
But when she stood up again and put weight on it, I caught her wincing.
"A lot of help you were,"
Enoch growled at me.
"Run away," says the Hollow Slayer's grandson.
If my grandfather had run from the hollow that killed him, he might still be alive, I said. "It's good advice." I heard a thud from beyond the wall we'd just scaled, and the feeling churned up inside me again. I went to the ledge and looked over. The hollow was alive and well at the base of the wall, and busy punching holes in the rock with its tongues.
"Bad news," I said. "The fall didn't kill it."
In a moment, Emma was at my side.
"What's it doing?"
I watched it twist one of its tongues into a hole it had made, then hoist itself up and begin making a second. It was creating footholds, or tongue holds, rather.
"It's trying to climb the wall," I said. "Good God, it's like the freaking Terminator."
"The what?" said Emma.
I almost started to explain, then shook my head. It was a stupid comparison anyway. Hologast were scarier, and probably deadlier, than any movie monster.
"We have to stop it," said Olive.
"Or better yet, run," said Horace.
"No more running," said Enoch. Can we please just kill the damn thing?
Sure, Emma said. But how? Anyone got a vat of boiling oil? Said Enoch.
Will this do instead?
I heard Bronwyn say, and turned to see her lifting a boulder above her head.
It might, I said. How's your aim? Can you drop it where I tell you?
I'll certainly try,
Bronwyn said, tottering toward the ledge with the rock balanced precariously on her hands. We stood looking over the ledge.
Farther this way,
I said, urging her a few steps to the left.
Just as I was about to give the signal for her to drop the boulder, though, the hollow leapt from one hold to the next, and now she was standing in the wrong place. The hollow was getting faster at making the holds. Now it was a moving target. To make matters worse, Bronwyn's boulder was the only one in sight. If she missed, we wouldn't get a second shot.
I forced myself to stare at the hollow despite a nearly unbearable urge to look away. For a few strange, head-swimmy seconds, the voices of my friends faded away, and I could hear my own blood pumping in my ears and my heart thumping in the cavity of my chest, and my thoughts drifted to the creature that killed my grandfather, that stood over his torn and dying body before fleeing, cowardly, into the woods. My vision rippled, and my hands shook. I tried to steady myself.
You were born for this,
I thought to myself. You were built to kill monsters like this. I repeated it under my breath like a mantra.
Hurry up, please, Jacob, Bronwyn said. The creature faked left, then jumped right. I didn't want to guess and throw away our best chance at killing it. I wanted to know. And somehow, for some reason, I felt that I could.
I knelt so close to the cliff's edge now that Emma hooked two fingers through the back of my belt to keep me from falling. Focusing on the hollow, I repeated the mantra to myself,
built to kill you, built to kill.
And though the hollow was for the moment stationary, hacking away at one spot on the wall, I felt the compass needle in my gut prick ever so slightly to the right of it. It was like a premonition. Bronwyn was beginning to tremble under the boulder's weight.
I can't hold this much longer, she said.
I decided to trust my instinct. Even though the spot my compass pointed to was empty, I shouted for Bronwyn to drop the boulder there. She angled toward it and, with a groan of relief, let go of the rock. The moment after she let go, the hollow leapt to the right, into the very place my compass had pointed. The hollow looked up to see the rock sailing toward it and poised to jump again, but there wasn't time. The boulder slammed into the creature's head and swept its body off the wall. With a thunderous crash, hollow and boulder hit the ground together. Tentacled tongues shot out from beneath the rock, shivered, went limp. Black blood followed, fanning around the boulder in a great viscous puddle.
Direct hit!
I yelled. The kids began to jump and cheer.
It's dead! It's dead!
Olive cried.
The horrible hollow is dead!
Bronwyn threw her arms around me. Emma kissed the top of my head. Horace shook my hand and Hugh slapped me on the back. Even Enoch congratulated me.
Good work, he said, a bit reluctantly.
Now don't go getting a big head over it.
I should have been overjoyed, but I hardly felt anything, just a spreading numbness as the trembling pain of the feeling receded. Emma could see I was drained. Very sweetly, and in a way no one else could quite detect, she took my arm and half-supported me as we walked away from the ledge.
That wasn't luck, she whispered in my ear. I was right about you, Jacob Portman.
The path that had dead-ended at the bottom of the wall began again here at the top, following the spine of a ridge up and over a hill.
The sign on the rope said access to menagerie, said Horace. Do you suppose that's what's ahead?
You're the one who dreams about the future, said Enoch. Suppose you tell us.